faith-filled finance. All major UK bank accounts. One app. Provision is built by Christians to help you steward what God's given you. Track your spending, saving and giving in one place. Join the waitlist now at provision.money and get your first month free. That's provision.money.
Premier Podcast.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. I'm the editor of Premier Christianity Magazine, and that is the UK's leading Christian magazine. It sponsors this show and makes it all possible. If you would like a free sample copy of our latest issue featuring interviews, news, reviews, and so much more, you can request one completely free, premierchristianity.com/free sample. But today, right here on The Profile, I am speaking to the sitcom writer, author, and proud Calvinist, James Carey. He's worked on mainstream hits such as the BBC's My Family and Miranda. He's produced plays, including a comedy about the Reformation, A Monk's Tale. And he's also a member of the Church of England's General Synod. He's the author of a new book, The Sacred Art of Joking, published by SPCK and out now. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. And proud Calvinist is a new one for me. Humble Calvinist, surely. You can't be a proud Calvinist. Well, that's not allowed.
This is the thing. Is Calvinist and comedian a contradiction?
It's a good point. I don't think a lot of people don't really know what Calvinism is, but I think, I don't know whether I would die on a hill for Calvinism as it is, but it seems like a fairly good summary of most of my relatively reformed,
yes,
relatively Presbyterian views, which mostly overlap with the Church of England, whom I represent in the my own diocese, the funniest diocese, the Diocese of Bath and Wells, because we have the funniest bishop. So because it's the bishop in Blackadder, obviously. So it's a fairly good description of, like, I'm that kind of Christian.
Yes.
Because no one likes to be pigeonholed.
No.
But everyone does like shorthand.
Exactly.
And so
this is why the terms get used. It's easy shorthand to sort of put you in a particular theological position.
Absolutely, yeah. And so I sort of believe in most of the things that Calvinists tend to believe in, and that's fine by me. Just saves time.
People do the whole thing of adding up how many point Calvinist are you, because there's 5 points, and last time I checked, I think I was only about a 3 out of 5.
Okay.
So maybe by the end of this interview, you would have moved me on a little bit.
I don't even know what the 5 are, but I sort of...
But is it not true, though, that sometimes those who take the Reformed label, rightly or wrongly, have a reputation of being a bit stern and a bit severe?
Absolutely. And so I have to... One of the things I talk about in the book is that my own theological tribe, as it were, are the ones who, when they had the opportunity, shut all the theatres in England. So Oliver Cromwell, who is in some ways a hero of the faith, probably quite a difficult man in other ways, especially if you're the King of England, I guess. when he was Lord Protector, he shut all the theatres,
right,
and often say that he is a man who had very little use for light entertainment. And before the Reformation, which is a thing that I celebrate and enjoy, I wrote a show about it called A Monk's Tale. Before that, there were mystery plays in which guilds used to come together and tell the Christian story theatrically, and that kind of all went by the wayside. And so there are lots of good aspects of the old faith, as it were, where we expressed these things in a way that was very much of the people, but we sort of owned the Christian story. And we sort of lost that now, and we've become in some ways more theologically accurate, and that's great and very bookish, but in terms of storytelling, I think that has suffered. And in terms of the other thing that's that Calvinists like, which is where they kind of overlap with the sort of authoritarian Catholic thing, is that desire to control, mm-hmm, and to not let things become chaotic. And of course, comedy is inherently anarchic.
Right.
It is intrinsically
disruptive.
And the moment you open a door for that, you don't really know what's going to come piling through. And it's always therefore easier just to keep the door locked. And so that's why I think the church has traditionally had a sense of humor,
yes,
problem. But equally, you know, there are more liberal progressive traditions who just say, oh, it's fine, get over it, have a sense of humor, which theologically isn't good enough. You know,
right,
we have to kind of do better than that.
Yeah.
But I think there are lots of, but I think we can be much more relaxed about comedy if we actually do the reading and do the thinking.
Yes.
And can be more comfortable with offence and offending people.
Yeah.
And you really only need to look at the ministry of Jesus to say, well, Jesus was way more comfortable offending people than we are.
Mm.
And my worry is that whenever a Christian expresses themselves in a way that other Christians think is graceless or tactless or rude, that they will be critiqued and criticized for not being sufficiently winsome, is a word that certain Christians use rather a lot. And you think, yeah, Jesus often wasn't winsome.
No. Well, I mean, just in that, you've hinted at about 25 things I'd love to
dig
deeper into. We'll see how we go in the course of the next hour or so.
Yeah.
But here on the show, we always like to go right back to the beginning of a person's life and hear something of their early life and faith. So I'm guessing you were born neither a Calvinist nor a Christian. So tell me about life growing up.
I was always destined to be a Calvinist, as you would well know, but the faith that chooses you. So I was brought up in a fairly traditional English rural home. My parents are dairy farmers. We would go to church a bit, but it wasn't really ever part of, it's never really been part of our family life. My parents didn't read the Bible with me, or we didn't really pray at bedtime or anything like that. But I went to a school where it was where the Christian faith was taught extremely well, extremely clearly. There were very good role models there that I really looked up to, and it just kind of all made sense. And I realized this is a consistent worldview that I think is a really good description of the world that we all want, that we intrinsically know is true, and that I can either live my life pretending it's not true, or I can just become a Christian, and there we go.
So it was almost more through school than it was family.
It was school.
Wow.
It was exclusively school, and various sort of teachers and other school.
And was
folks.
It a Christian school?
It was a very Christian school, right. Yeah. And it's a school that was originally set up for the children of missionaries. And it's never really, and lots of Christian schools are now not terribly Christian, but this one was and still is. And I would happily send my kids there if I had the money to do so. And those schools now are sort of twice the price that they were when I was being sent through those schools for reasons that I don't fully understand. So, and then I went through, and obviously I had questions, and you think there are a lot. And when I was about 15 or 16, I read The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, which was the supposedly non-fiction book on which the Da Vinci Code was based.
Okay.
And I remember thinking, wow, is the whole of Christianity a deception or a lie? And then I thought, you know what, if I study theology at university, this stuff will probably come up if there's anything to it. And it kind of didn't.
Right.
And so I did an academic theology degree, and my faith survived that perfectly intact.
Yeah.
And
it's so interesting. We have a lot of people come through and sit in this chair that you're sitting in right now, and I always hear very mixed reports from people who did theology, particular in a secular or mainstream university setting.
Yeah.
Some say it really rocked my faith.
Mm.
Others say, fine, no problems. You were in the latter.
Very much so. Yeah, I think in a way I wasn't. I mean, I was too busy writing comedy sketches, really, and doing other things. So my degree was the thing that I sort of had to do because I was at university. And, I would...
Sounds familiar to a lot of students,
yeah,
I'm sure.
And I'd agree. And many people listening to the show would just think that education is wasted on the young. And I think that's absolutely right. And the idea of having 3 years off now to just go and read books, I just can't think of anything more wonderful.
I know.
But there we
it's
go.
It's funny, isn't it? We don't think like that. Well, I didn't think like that as a student necessarily. You get a bit older, you think, wow, those were three brilliant years.
They were three brilliant years where I should have read more books. But so it was... It wasn't something that I found particularly challenging to my faith, and I sort of, there were plenty of skeptical theology tutors and things. I didn't think that their knockdown anti-Christian arguments were terribly convincing, and I wasn't particularly minded to get into a serious battle with them because they'd clearly made up their minds, and that was that really. And I spent more time. Writing sketches and writing stuff for the university newspaper. And
so you were interested in comedy again from an early age, were you?
Yeah, I've just always loved comedy. To the point where I sort of didn't really see the point of anything else on television other than comedy, apart from test match cricket. and I've always wanted to understand it. I've always wanted to know why it was how does it work? And if you want, and not from a particularly performance point of view, so I've only recently started doing more comedy performing, but for 20 years I've not really done that because I've not felt that I want to be the one out there being funny and getting laughs, and it's not the sound of laughter and that intoxicating feeling that comedians really like, for good or ill. But it's more that I just love the puzzle of what works and what doesn't work. And yes, it's so when I do radio recordings, particularly, I sort of sit in the audience and no one around me knows that I'm the writer of the show, and I'm not going to tell them. But it's interesting just to hear what they laugh at, yes, and what they don't laugh at. Yes. And it's almost like a crossword puzzle where you just think, oh, they laughed at that one. I was right about that. Oh, that they laughed at that one. And then, oh, they didn't laugh at that one. Oh, that's interesting. Why didn't they? And they really laughed at that one. I didn't think that one was that funny.
It's almost like all of the power and none of the glory, because it's the power in the pen to put words in people's mouths. But like you say, you don't get the glory because no one knows that you wrote it necessarily. It's not actually that dissimilar to editing a magazine.
Well, there we
go. I'm not necessarily writing the material. Yeah. My name isn't necessarily on some of the features, yeah, but I've edited them and I've shaped them.
Yeah.
And again, what you talk about with the feedback and sitting in the audience seeing what laughs, it's always interesting to see how people respond to certain features. And
you got your own podcast, so you know, there you go.
Don't get me wrong, I do still write as well, but I get the dynamic of being behind the scenes.
Yeah. And you just sort of, and also once you start working with decent comedy actors, and back in those days when I started out doing radio, you know, I was working with at least two women who've now won or been nominated for Oscars. One was Olivia Colman and one was Sally Hawkins. And you know, and they're good. And once you start working with people who are good, you just think, well, they're better at it than I am. For goodness sake, just let them sell the material,
right,
and I'll figure out the jokes. So you sort of quickly work out what you're good at and what other people do better than you. And I think that's an important part of that process.
I imagine this whole area of comedy writing must be incredibly competitive and tough to get into, and not always easy to make a living from. Am I right in any of those assumptions?
I think there's an 20 years ago when I was starting out, it might have been easier because there were fewer people doing it. And now everyone's a writer, or everyone wants to be a writer. I guess back then there were fewer channels and fewer opportunities, but I think there were fewer people going for it. But equally, you couldn't make your own stuff back then anywhere near like you could now. Podcasting didn't exist. YouTube didn't exist. And the sort of camera that we're, you know, recording bits of this interview on, those bits of kit were £30,000-£40,000,
yep,
or you could rent them for a day for 800,
yeah,
and they'd come with a big guy called Steve who'd know how to operate it. Steve, Jeff, Pete, Dave, all cameramen are called one of those things, Barry. But now you can kind of make your own stuff, and it is really interesting to see how it all shakes out, because now we live in a world where the Crown spends £10 million on an episode, and then you have a sitcom that is made for £250,000 for half an hour. And for some reason, comedy always gets less money. But also there's this weird law that the more expensive a comedy is, the less funny it is.
Right.
So I think the most expensive comedy movie there's been was Tropic Thunder, which cost about $75
million. Wow.
Wasn't great.
Yeah.
And all of the great movies, all of the great comedy movies like the Python movies or Spinal Tap or With Nell and I, they were made for nothing. Absolute shoestring. So it's kind of annoying that comedy is cheap to make, and that adversity really focuses your mind on what all the jokes are and everything. And I think there's an expectation of the audience that I was talking to my literary agent actually weirdly today about how the audience immediately understand if it's a sitcom that it doesn't, that the rules, different rules apply, and they're watching Blackadder the second in the court of Elizabeth. Obviously it's not really the court of Elizabeth, it's obviously a studio. There are no extras, there's just the Queen and her and Nursey and Lord Melchard, and that's it, and no one cares. We get it, it's a cartoon, so the audience is super smart on that. But then the moment you start going high end and you show them everything, and, you know, watching The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, for example, you just think, oh my goodness, this show is so expensive. You did all that in one shot. And only people in television actually noticed that, but you did it anyway.
Yeah. So was there a moment for you in your career you look back on as, oh, that was my big break?
I think people like the idea of a big break, and there undoubtedly are big breaks, but it's sort of a series of breaks, really, where you know, getting your first credit on the radio for me. I got a sketch on Weekending on Radio 4, and then getting a TV credit on a TV show called Smack the Pony, becoming nominated for Perrier Best Newcomer at the Edinburgh Fringe in 1999, which was nice. But then that helped me get a radio sitcom commissioned, and that won a Sony Silver Sony Radio Award, and we lost to a special episode of, you know, I'm sorry, I haven't the clue. It's like, well, okay, I'm not gonna beat that with my first ever sitcom episode. You know, and then I got to work on something else, which then led to this, which then led to that, which then led to Miranda, which then led to Bluestone 4-2, which then led to, you know, working on other shows. And so in a way, one thing leads to another, and you sort of just kind of roll with it, really. And there's, if you took out one or two of those, maybe it wouldn't have made that much difference. If you took out five of them, but then also, if other things had happened, maybe I'd be living in LA, making a lot more money, making very different shows. But I'm not sure that would be an improvement. And
so when you write some of the bigger things, do you get to meet the big name actors who are playing the parts? And
well, yeah, I mean,
do you have all of those stories of, you know, so-and-so is a right, you know, so-and-so off camera?
Yes, you do. And my lips very much are sealed on that score. But yeah, no, it's a team effort, TV. And everyone has to, I would say, especially TV comedy, is made for surprisingly small amounts of money and is recorded after surprisingly small amounts of rehearsal. So I've just done a new show about the murder of Thomas Beckett, and we spent two whole weeks rehearsing it and performing it again and again and again and again. And then we're going to do a few more shows and that kind of stuff. But it's kind of not finished yet. It's not ready. But a TV sitcom is rehearsed in 3 days, 4 days, and then you record it, and that's it. It's going to be on UK Gold like that forever. And there's just no time to do anything, so everyone's just working as hard as they can and trying to get along with each other. And some people are difficult or hard to like or very particular, and they get to dig their heels in, and sometimes they're right to do that, and sometimes,
presumably on set, there can be tweaking of lines
all the time
as well.
Yeah.
Does that ever cause tension if an actor wants to change what you've written and you're thinking, no, it works better the other way?
Well, you do get those little things. And in general, I'm pretty flexible. And once an actor has a problem with a line, trying to convince them that the line is fine is a bit of a waste of time, because they're starting to panic. They don't like the line. They don't want to say it. Just change it.
Right.
It's so unlikely that that exact version of that line is absolutely load-bearing, mission-critical. They have to say that way then.
Yeah.
So there is not, I think, some, you know, there is not a platonic ideal of every single script which you're trying to get your script to be like. You know, you're rewriting and rewriting and rewriting, and the only thing that stops that process is you literally run out of time and you have to start rehearsing it, and then you're rewriting it a bit more, and then you've got to film it, and then you edit it, and then it's broadcast and it's done.
Yeah.
You know, you can't do anything now, even if you wanted to. Yeah.
What do your friends in the your friends and colleagues in the comedy world make of your faith?
I think they're very nice to me personally. I don't know what they say when I'm not there. I presume they think I'm a little bit weird, because Christians tend not to go into this line of work for reasons that are partly linked to what we've already said before about that my particular faith tribe tends not to send people into the entertainment industry, and tends to send people who are good with words into ministry.
It tends to criticize the entertainment industry quite a lot. We'll come on to talk about some of this as well a little bit later on. I mean, along those lines, though, are you the only comedian who voted for Brexit?
It would appear so. I was at the Craft of Comedy Awards a couple of years ago, and the Radio 4 Today program were there, and they sort of said, did anyone here vote Brexit? And literally vote to leave. And I just said, yep, put my hand up. I was literally the only person in the room.
Only person in the room.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't care.
You're not bothered.
Not really. No. I mean, I'm a pretty contrary person, and I think you kind of need to be a writer, or to, you know, I think it's a personality issue as well. So, you know,
It is odd, though. You talk about being contrary, because, just okay, as someone who's in their 20s, who lives in London, who works in the media, all of the parameters for that would suggest that I voted to remain, right?
Yes.
That is basically, you believe the statistics. Yeah. And so I constantly live and work in an environment which is actually opposite to the majority, because, of course, the majority did vote to leave.
Yeah.
And yet in the media world, in London, amongst my age group, everything I'm hearing is opposite to that.
Yeah.
So weirdly, for yourself, you're in the majority because you voted to leave.
Yeah.
And yet must feel like for you as well, as if you're in a slightly backwards world where a lot of what you're hearing, a lot of the people you're interacting with are the opposite, even though they're not in the majority.
It is a very much down is up kind of political time, isn't it? And which is why, you know, I don't listen to an awful lot of radio news or TV news, and it's all a bit of a mess. But yeah, no, it is strange, isn't it, to be sort of made to feel like you're in the minority, but it's like, no, we won.
You did actually win.
We did actually win. I mean, we haven't left yet, and we may never leave. Certainly that's kind of the way that it appears that the establishment would like it to be. But I'm fairly relaxed about it as well. I don't take it particularly personally. I can't even believe there was a referendum. So the fact that there was, I have such a low view of politics, because one of the other things I describe myself as a classical liberal,
right.
I don't really believe in politics, is I just assumed that even if we won the referendum, that we would sort of be told, oh, well, we shall take full account of these views, and that would be that. And then in 10 years' time, we would go, hang on, didn't we vote to leave the EU? And it was like, but you didn't really. And that's the end of that. Because the political establishment are really not terribly interested in what people actually think. And I understand why, because they just think, well, give them half a chance, they bring back the death penalty and hanging or whatever. You know, which also, I have fairly mixed views about. So it's, again, I don't really lose a lot of sleep over it. It doesn't make me particularly angry.
Yeah.
But it does, you know, on social media make people surprisingly angry. But
yes. So we've talked a little bit about what those in the comedy world think of Christianity. But what do Christians think of what you do for a day job? Are there any kind of common misconceptions you find when you walk into church on a Sunday morning?
I think on one level, there's always the suspicion that if you work for the BBC that which I've never been an employee of the BBC, but
you've worked on stuff that's gone on the BBC.
Yeah, and I mean, sort of 95% of my scripted comedy has been broadcast by the BBC TV or radio.
Right.
The church, especially my kind of church, they don't have that much good to say about the BBC in terms of the prevailing political and religious messages that are put out in terms of sort of progressive liberal leftism. Mm-hmm. I think in some ways, far be it for me to defend the BBC, considering how the BBC is predominantly run by and populated by people who are liberal left, socially progressive, I'm surprised at how fair it actually is.
Right.
And that it does employ quite a lot, and actually quite a lot of the big hitters like Andrew Neil, no one could accuse them of being liberal left socialists. So, you know, I think I have some sympathy with the BBC on this one. But yeah, I think the thing that people always get hung up on, well, actually weirdly, the thing that people really get hung up on is swearing and bad language. And therefore, I wrote a show called Bluestone 4-2 about soldiers in Afghanistan. And people would be quite surprised to learn that a Christian was a co-writer of that show, because the way the soldiers talk, to which I would say, That's how soldiers talk. I don't know if you've ever met any soldiers, but and actually soldiers who watch it sometimes do early episodes. The soldiers said, where's all the swearing? You know, we swear a lot, right? And we're like, yeah, we've already got a lot of swearing. But they just they don't even know how much they swear. They say swear words literally all the time.
Right.
It's just part of the way they talk. So we sort of had to back off that. But, you know, also when an IED goes off and blows up near you, You don't say, oh dear.
Yeah.
That's not the words that they use. And so it would be a sort of a bit of a nonsense to write stuff that is just basically untruthful. And on another level as well, I often say to Christians who are offended by the language, it's like, well, good, you should be. And if you're not offended by the language, I'd be more worried. So you can watch it and you can, as C.S. Lewis talks about, surrender to the art form. And you've not sullied yourself by being offended by something, because, you know, we want to help people who are in who have made poor life choices and now and this and that. And so as Christians, we want to be with people who you know, we're not made unclean by being with them in the same way. Yes. We're not being made unclean.
I guess the response to that sometimes is, my day-to-day life, I want to reach out to anyone, regardless of whether they're using bad language or not. Yeah. I just don't want to be entertained by bad language.
Okay, well, don't watch it then. I'm completely comfortable with the idea that... And I don't like bad language. So The Thick of It was a show I really, really did like. I think they went overboard on the bad language and they sort of tried to turn it into an art form, whereas we tried to have it more as this is just how they talk. And actually, intentionally, we never had any serious swearing in the first scene, the pre-title sequence, because we didn't want to put people off with the language. So we were always very careful to say, we don't think swearing is clever because it's really very easy to do. But equally, this is the world. So, and again, you know your conscience. And if you as a Christian think, I don't, you know, watching that kind of stuff, I think is wrong, fine. I have no problem with you not watching it. I don't think you're at liberty to tell me that I shouldn't have written it. If watching that language makes you want to use that language, then you should also review whether you should do it, in the same way that if you watch something like Game of Thrones with lots of nudity in, if that causes you to stumble, well, you know, be responsible. But I think, you know, Calvinists particularly, we sort of like rules. And so we say, no, you can't watch this, you can't do that. And actually, Jesus's ministry, the Bible itself, contains very, very troubling, strange images. One of the things I look at in the book is that there are very rude words in the Bible that we have changed and euphemized because we don't like the scatological sort of toilet words that are used occasionally, not very often, but occasionally.
Yes.
And, you know, we've all been in church.
Paul in particular has very interesting language to do with...
I consider them rubbish.
Yes, it's not rubbish,
yes,
is it?
Yes, it isn't
another word beginning with S.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yes, it is a really interesting one to think, wow, there might actually be words that, to our mind at least, are, if not swearing, them very close to swearing in the Bible itself.
So Christians can latch onto the language because it seems like such a hot button thing, and yet have a bit of a blind spot to the fact that you do know that people are getting shot dead in this show, and you're fine with that.
Yeah.
Okay. You do know there's a commandment of you shall not murder.
I'm Sam Hales. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio and my interview with the sitcom writer James Carey. Lots more to come on the show. We'll be back right after this.
Premier Christianity Magazine. In this month's issue,
another street preacher arrested. A nurse sacked for sharing her faith. Many are asking, is secularism on the rise? And if so, what should we do about it? Plus, we interview Christian Concerns' Andrea Williams, the worship leader Lou Fellingham, and the woman who survived the Rwandan genocide and learned to forgive her enemies. And if you're wondering which of the many Christian festivals to attend this summer, we've got a quiz to help you decide.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. Today I'm in conversation with the sitcom writer James Carey. At the end of part one, we were talking about different Christian attitudes towards swearing on TV, and James mentioned that he's written a show called Bluestone 4-2, which is about a bomb disposal unit in Afghanistan and how that show does contain some bad language. Let's pick up the rest of the conversation about that and lots more still to come on the show, so don't go anywhere. Here is the rest of my conversation with James Carey.
And one of the characters in the show is a squaddie called Mac, who is basically a psychopath, and he joined the army because he wants to shoot people. Mm. And in the Christmas special, we had a great one of my favorite darkest lines is when they get a call out on Christmas Day and they get ambushed by the Taliban. He starts shooting them, and he's shot one and he's shot another one, and he uses a swear word and says, wow, it really is Christmas. And you think, phew, that's a pretty dark thing. But that's like, people like that join the army.
Yeah.
And you kind of need people like that to join the army.
It's almost a coping mechanism, isn't it? Some of that kind of humour.
And so I'm not condoning that psychopathic behaviour.
Yeah.
But for some reason, Christians are more worried about language.
Yes.
And nudity. than all of these other things, which are far more insidious.
Well, I have
like
heard,
Love Island or these sorts of things.
Yeah, I have heard people say before though as well, from a Christian perspective, that everything preaches a message.
Yeah.
So like you say, okay, if you want to get hung up on certain words or nudity or whatever, but what's the overall message that a film or a TV show or a piece of music is communicating? I mean, you mentioned something like Love Island. I've often thought, you know, most romantic comedies, aside from whether there's sex in it or language or whatever else, the message that's communicated about love and relationships often, I would argue, is a pretty terrible message.
Yeah.
So for you as a writer, are you thinking more about what's the overall message that's being preached through something I'm writing more than does it contain swear words?
Yeah, I think situation comedy, traditionally understood at least, is profoundly Judeo-Christian in terms of the stories that you're telling. And you're always showing that moral choices have consequences.
Right, okay.
And you distort and you change them and you abbreviate some and you extend others. But you know, that's what parables are. They don't tell the whole story. They're just telling a snapshot. They're telling one angle of a story. And so sitcoms are kind of compressed versions of reality. And we know that if Miranda, say, tells a lie at the beginning of the show, that lie is going to have to be exposed at some point and the consequences will come out and she will suffer the consequences for lying. If somebody is proud in a show, then we know that they are going to be humbled. And that is a cathartic thing that I'm in favor of. And I think that sitcom does that very well. They are little morality tales. They are little mystery plays that follow that Judeo-Christian pattern. And I think there are lots of comedies now which kind of don't do that. And they tend not to rate very well. They tend to critically do well because they seem very strange and challenging. But ultimately, there is a nihilism at the heart of them, which isn't terribly funny. Because it's not very rewarding, because we are programmed by God, because we are made in God's image, for that Judeo-Christian ethic, and therefore we shouldn't be surprised that it tends to be satisfying when we get it. And the classics remain classics because they're written with that in mind, even though there are always mixed messages and they're not written by Christians or performed by Christians. But I think within that traditional form of storytelling, it has come from a Judeo-Christian culture. And so I'm sort of fairly comfortable at it. And so in the case of Bluestone 4-2 about soldiers, it's a show about why soldiers love being soldiers. And it's about their friendship and the fact that although they're teasing each other all the time, the moment there's a threat to that group, they will do anything for each other. And so it's actually a strangely very warm-hearted show that I think really does describe why soldiers wants to go to war and want to experience that camaraderie and being a band of brothers that you just don't really get in any other sort of situation.
And Bluestone 4-2 is available on iPlayer.
Yeah, I think it is currently on iPlayer, And it is also available on DVD.
There
so,
you go.
So buy the DVD and I'll make slightly more money
there
that way.
There you go.
But only slightly.
I don't want to dwell too much longer on the content question because I think, like we've said, Christians talk about it a lot and there's actually loads more interesting things I want to talk to. But just one more question on kind of content, because you've already mentioned Game of Thrones and that's a classic that comes up and Christians debate should we watch this or not. And I know there are many supposed issues with Game of Thrones, but I think one of them is violence and the high level of violence. And you do still hear Christians talk about, oh, that's too violent, I wouldn't want to watch that necessarily. My question about this is more about what's happened over time, because you could argue that what is considered now quite normal in terms of graphic violence in film and TV, even just a couple of generations ago, we never would have gone anywhere near it. It would have been viewed as way too extreme. So some people think there's almost a bit of a slippery slope going on. As time goes on, we seem to be comfortable, actually, with more and more gratuitous violence. Is there any truth in that? And is that something that should concern Christians in any way?
I think there is truth in that. There is undoubtedly an escalation of these things. I really don't like violence at all. And so that is the bits where I really look away at Game of Thrones. I do sometimes take my glasses off so that I can't see it. And so I can only hear it. And I fast forward those bits sometimes as well, because I don't feel I need that. Having said that, it is good for it to feel like it matters. It does need to feel real. There was a kid's book that I actually stop reading for a bit because my kids are finding a bit too much. There's a book by a guy called Nate Wilson called 100 Cupboards. And the second book, it's sort of particularly aimed, I think, at young boys, and it's a bit sort of Narnia-ish and stuff. But actually, the boy experienced some physical pain that I think was really well written and really felt like it hurt. And it was just words on the page. And my kids found it quite uncomfortable.
Right.
And I thought, that's pretty good because pain needs to be experienced. You need to feel it. You know, like if you're a writer, I can't remember who was it who said it, most things are either Mark Twain or someone like that, or C.S. Lewis. About you don't want
wrongly attributed. Yeah,
don't tell the audience it's raining. Make them feel like they're being rained on,
right?
And that kind of
yes.
thing. So, but the thing is that, you know, our tastes do change, and the conventions of storytelling do change, but they change really fast. And so putting pins in the ground doesn't tend to work, because you now look back at shows from the 90s that are comedies and you just think, wow, that's sexually very creepy and predatory in a way that was deemed to be funny and mainstream.
Yes.
And we wouldn't do that now. And there are things that are sort of violent that don't seem to be very realistic or seem cartoonish. And there are things now that seem much too realistic. But then also, you know, it's all going downhill. Okay, well, in the 40s, we actually carpet bombed entire cities. And that was fine, apparently, because they started it. And you think, well, we kind of wouldn't do that now. So, and that's why I think the human standards of morality don't really work for me, because they change.
Yes.
And that's why
it's not as simple.
I'm a Bible fan.
Right.
Because let's take our cues from God's sublime, inerrant word. And then we can argue about that.
Yes. So it's not as simple as everything's getting better or everything's getting worse.
No, yeah. I think that's right. And there are things that you do watch where you just think, oh, I used to love this show, and you watch it and just think, ooh.
There was that thing about, I think it was probably my generation, millennials, or the generation underneath, whatever that is, generation
Z?
Z or something.
Maybe, I don't know.
Watching Friends on Netflix.
Yeah.
And some apparently being quite shocked at what they thought were inappropriate jokes. Of course, not that long ago.
Yeah.
You know, 90s or early 2000s were absolutely fine. And like you say, things can move on very, very quickly.
Yeah, and there's no end to that. And therefore, that's not a role you want to go
down.
And
this is one of the things your book does so well in bringing out the context, why context matters with joking. In fact, I think I got a pre-release copy of the book, and I think this page of the book might have been removed for the real thing. But the copy of the book I had, this is The Sacred Art of Joking, published by SPCK, there was like a whole page in big print that said, if you're a journalist, please read
this
bit
there.
First. Is it still there?
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
Tell us about what I then read. Because as you can imagine, as a journalist flicking through, I then immediately had to read that bit.
Of course you did. Yeah, that's right. And I'm glad it had the desired effect. It's one of those things whereby whenever you hear comedy discussed on television, it's one of the least funny things ever is the presenter of Newsnight reading out a joke to a comedian that he, you know, a joke that he did in front of a member of a pressure group who was mortally offended by that joke. And they say, in your so-called comedy routine, you said blah 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 blah, is that funny? To which the answer is, well, no, not the way you did it. And it's not funny in an overlit Newsnight studio in front of someone whose job it is to be offended by this joke. So, whereas if you'd been a member of the paying audience in that club on that night and been part of the context of the original joke, then you would have been less offended. You still might be offended, and that would be fine to still be offended and to defend the right to tell the joke or to admit that maybe the joke was a mistake, but ultimately, who cares?
Yeah.
Or that this is a sin and not a crime, which is a sort of another sort of theme of the book. So the context really, really does matter. And comedians know that. And therefore, the kind of jokes that they tell, if you pay 15 quid to go to a comedy club, if you go to the comedy store, the midnight show, you are opening yourself up to a robust form of comedy that you wouldn't expect to see piped into your home on Live at the Apollo.
Right.
And you know, and David Frost,
I think many people don't know or understand that, because when I read that bit in your book, I thought, I'm not sure if I'd completely understood really the dynamic to which that is true. Like you say, when you go to certain comedy clubs at certain times in the evening or certain people are playing, you're right, actually, that the level of comedy for some people is going to be much more offensive than what would make it onto, like you say, some of the, once it's been through the broadcasters and is kind of written for a wider audience, some of it isn't as as biting, you know, yeah. comedy.
And there's a great David Frost quote about the television allows you to be entertained by people that you wouldn't normally let in the house. But even then, comedians still do moderate stuff that's when it's televised, unless you're Frankie Boyle or something, right. in which case your reputation is based on irritating people or saying things that are unsayable. And, I don't particularly want to watch it, but I admire
his... You defend his right to do it.
I defend his right to do it, and I would defend the art form of sort of satirically irritating people. Uh-huh. And I myself wouldn't do it, but that style of comedy doesn't work for me. Yeah. That's not what I would want to do.
There's been a lot in the media recently, and I think this is a subject that almost certainly would concern you, of comedians almost falling foul of, it appears, the law at times, simply yeah. for making a joke. Yeah. And people are worrying now about this culture of offence, of because I'm offended, someone deserves to be arrested for it almost.
Well, yeah, it's a disaster. I mean, and that's, the law is already terrible. And I would argue tyrannical, because the police could sort of arrest virtually any comedian ever, because you only need to prove the possible perception of someone being offended in order to be prosecuted under the Prevention of Terrorism 2003 Act, or whatever it is, the specific references in the book. And that's how Count Dankula was prosecuted for playing a joke on his girlfriend by making her beautiful little pug dog do a Nazi salute. And he used a phrase in that, which is very offensive, I'm not going to say on the thing. And, you know, it was... He's had to pay a fine. He's had to pay an £800 yeah. fine for that. He is a criminal. That is a criminal offence, what yeah. he's done, for a act that was designed to prevent terrorism.
Yeah.
And so the laws that are already in place are a disaster. And so it is only... So when people are up in arms that the police are investigating these crimes, so-called, it's not, well, they're only doing their job. It's the lawmakers right. and the politicians who yeah. have, you know, produced... really bad legislation, which is very worrying. And Rowan Atkinson, to his credit, has always been very public about this. He doesn't talk about much, he doesn't give many interviews, but his freedom of speech passion, I think, yes. is really important.
And I wonder if this is one of the areas, actually, where the two worlds that you represent yeah. of comedy and kind of Christianity, there's a real meeting point here, because I think Christians share this concern. It's not just those in the comedy world that Absolutely. Are concerned, what about our freedom of speech? Christians are increasingly kind of scared. I mean, there have been a number of cases of street preachers being arrested. They, to my knowledge, almost always are released without charge, doesn't go any further. But even the fact they're being arrested in the first place for standing on a street corner, and sometimes it seems just reading out the Bible or saying some sort of yeah. Christian doctrine, that worries Christians, because
it should worry them,
because we think, can't we just say what we do? We not have freedom of yeah. speech?
No, we don't have freedom of speech. The Americans do. They have the First Amendment,
I guess, because there are laws, aren't there, you know, it's illegal to incite racial hatred, for example.
Yes.
So it seems that nobody, and I think most people can understand why that is the case. But it does represent a difficulty when it comes to, where do we draw the line in terms of what we think is okay to be said and what we think is beyond the pale. And actually, if you are trying to encourage others to beat up people just because they're a different skin colour, yeah. we don't want that either. So yeah. how do you figure out that?
I mean, incitement to violence is hard, pretty hard to justify. I mean, incitement to hatred, again, you just think, well, who defines that? I think there's a bit of a problem, is because of the kind of the hollowing out of our institutions and the atomization of our society, in terms of, it feels like we now have the individual and the state, and that's it. And we don't have we don't place importance on peer groups, on families, on institutions, on churches, on other organizations to monitor the way in which people speak and to ostracize them for the way they speak rather than prosecute them. It feels that the only way to make people behave is to pass a law. And that is a fundamental problem for me, which is why I'm a classical liberal in this regard, is because there is a fundamental understanding, or lack of understanding, that sins are not crimes. Some sins should be crimes, but there are some things where it's like, I don't want to cause offense necessarily with jokes. I'm comfortable with offense being caused at various points, but I don't there are people who say certain things or do certain jokes which I wouldn't do, and I think are tasteless. I think they're poorly executed. It's not a criminal offence to do that. No. It shouldn't be. I mean, yes. it is,
yeah.
but it shouldn't be. I think I'm kind of happy with someone being excommunicated from their church, for example, or given the cold shoulder, or Or, for example, in the Counts of Count Dankula, who with the Nazi saluting pug dog, which I sort of wrote about in greater length in the book. If YouTube want to take it down, they're a private company. They can do what they like if they're clear about what the rules are. I have no problem with that. But the moment that someone makes you feel bad means that the police should go and arrest them is a very, very serious worry. And I don't quite see how we're going to get out of that. Because that way tyranny lies.
Is there a warning here, though, again, for Christians who... I think you kind of argue in this book that sometimes we can be a little bit too quick to jump on the I'm offended bandwagon.
Absolutely.
And to even, you know, think, well, if the law's there and it, and you know, allows me to go and get someone else in trouble, let's stand up for ourselves. Come on, Christians, let's take this person to court or whatever.
Absolutely, which is why, you know, there's a whole chapter about, in fact, probably two or three chapters, about Jerry Springer, the opera, which I picked partly because it was a big deal at the time and partly because it's 10 years ago. We now have a little bit more perspective on it, and how there was a private prosecution brought against the writers of that show, which ultimately got thrown out, I would argue, on a bit of a technicality. But I don't think the law itself was a good law, and that law about the blasphemy law now doesn't exist. It's not, it has been sort of struck away from common law, which is what it was, I believe. I'm not an expert on these things. I'm kind of comfortable with the idea that Christians, if they want to stand outside a theatre and wave placards, fine. If you want to not buy something or not patronize something or boycott something because of this or that, well, okay, that's fine. If you're not prepared to watch it before you criticize it, I think that limits your capacity or legitimacy in terms of critiquing it. I don't need to watch it to know that it's wrong, for example. And I think, well, you, as a Christian, you may decide that you can't unsee what you've seen and therefore you don't want to, and that's fine. But as C.S. Lewis would argue, I've mentioned before, he says you do need to submit to the art form in order to be able to critique it. So I think there are so many factors at play that require just a little bit of a cool head and a little bit of a thought and a little bit of consideration about where this ultimately is going to lead. And I think you need to just be aware of, if you want the law to be changed to suit you, just think, how will this law be used against you? Because the state rightly has the power of coercion to, you know, they bear the sword, and that sword has been given to them by God. Therefore, we should be very careful what powers
how we allow them to use the sword.
Exactly. And I even teach my kids, as it were, and if I was prime minister, what law would I bring in? It's like, no, I would, you can't fix problems with laws. The only hope of salvation, the only hope of healing our bitterly divided society with also chronic issues of loneliness and dysfunction is the gospel of Jesus Christ. Politics is not going to fix that. It may make a few bits better for a while. It tends to make things worse. But it is a change of heart that our society needs, and that comes through the proclamation of the gospel. And therefore, Christians really should make sure that we are free to do that. And we are kind of in a dangerous situation where we are not.
Bring it back to churchy things. There's a great bit in the book where you talk about how a lot of churches will invest perhaps in making sure their choir sounds nice, they'll put a good PA system in, or you may go to a kind of church where there's a hired worship leader, and yet the public reading of scripture doesn't seem to get as much attention, in your view. Can you tell me a bit more about that observation? I found very interesting.
Well, to be honest, it was the thing I found most interesting in writing the book. It was one of the bits that I learned that I wasn't expecting to feel strongly about. And I've been around lots of churches because for various reasons, including sort of some of the theatre stuff that I do. And you do sort of find these sound desks that you could basically land a plane on or a helicopter, and tons of money being spent on music and worship. And that's fine. It's not for me to say that that's wrong. But it is very frustrating that the public reading of scripture is so badly done. And the reason I mention it in the book is because I want to argue that scripture is a lot funnier than we give it credit for. And there are lots of reasons why people aren't expecting to find it funny. And historically, Christians have a problem with this. And you're not expecting to laugh in church. And whenever Jesus is portrayed in art, he's always appearing serious, or he's got a 1,000-yard stare, or he looks sad or something for some reason. not fun to be with, as actually he probably was much more. But I argue that if you read scripture as written well, the most surprising thing that people find is how funny it is. and how surprising, especially the Gospels, the Gospel stories, the things that Jesus does and says, which we have now become bored of or used to. But actually, if you read them afresh, if you present them anew, not by rewriting them, not by updating them, not by changing the language, but by reading the actual language. And actors do that really well. And I've seen actors do it really well. There's a friend of mine called Bruce Kuhn who does that. He performs the Gospels verbatim.
I looked it up when you mentioned it in the book, and I was stunned. It was incredible.
It's great. And if in the room, it's even better. And
he's memorized it.
He's memorized it. But again, he says that memorizing is not actually that hard. It's almost like he teaches people how to memorize it by sort of helping them to visualize the event and using the text to prompt a retelling of that story. And again, you're using the same words of that story, but you're just giving it a freshness. Yeah. And when you do that, and also when you read longer passages of scripture, you note repetition, you note themes emerging, you note, you become more familiar with the humanity of the disciples and how strange it must have been and how, you know, how bizarre the transfiguration is. Can you imagine being with Jesus and going up the mountain and seeing him standing there with these two people? Is that Moses and Elijah? You know, hasn't Moses been dead for 1,000 years? And Elijah, to be fair, didn't die, but he went up to heaven in a chariot made of fire. That doesn't make it any less strange. I realize that. And Peter's kind of panics, and he sort of says, "I'll build you shelters." And you can imagine Elijah and Moses sort of looking at Jesus and going, "What's this guy doing?" And Jesus sort of saying, "Well, you know, you get used to it after a while. You know, he's with me. He's fine. You know, he'll run out of steam eventually." And so, if you kind of approach these things with a bit of a freshness to them, and if you think it can't be done, we have a really noble tradition of Shakespeare and Shakespearean comedies, and decent actors make Shakespeare funny.
Right.
Because it is funny, but it's in an unfamiliar language. It's an unfamiliar society with unfamiliar norms, as it were. But decent comedy actors bring that out. So when you're reading the Bible publicly, people now use it as a way of involving people in the service. And have they read the passage in advance? Probably not. And everyone cringes because they're about to hit the word Melchizedek and thinking, how on earth are they going to Melchizedek? And so, you know, everyone starts to get worried. And then the preacher has to spend the next 10 minutes kind of going over the passage and what happened, because it hasn't been read well. Actually, the preaching would really benefit from that as well. But we don't really have that tradition of making scripture alive. And Christian actors don't aspire to do scripture. They aspire to do Shakespeare. And I think that's a shame. But we've not painted a vision. We've not painted a bigger picture of what God's unadulterated word can do. You know, we're not firing blanks here when we read the scriptures. You know, it is a sharp sword. And if only we can actually take it out of the scabbard, then we might actually start getting somewhere.
It's a great challenge for anyone who is due to read next in church.
But here's the problem. If you do it really well, people will sort of go, "Oh, who do you think you are?" It's like, "Oh, you're bringing attention to yourself by reading the scripture well." It's just like, "Oh, okay, but so-and-so is allowed to be good at the guitar and that's fine, is it?"
Yeah.
So it's a big uphill struggle. It's a really big change of culture that we need. And I don't know how to do it, but I'm keen to give
back. Well, you've started it by putting it into our heads.
I've planted the flag right here.
That brings us nicely on to the fact that you are part of the Church of England.
I am.
Are you a comfortable member of the Church of England or an uncomfortable member of the Church of England?
I am satisfied that the 39 articles represent a reformed Christian faith to which I cheerfully submit. And so on paper, the Church of England's pretty awesome.
Right.
And there are multiple expressions of that in ways that I'm not comfortable, but in the way in which it is expressed in my home church in Somerset, I enjoy my church, and I'm proud to represent the Diocese of Bath and Wells at the General Synod and have a voice in that. You know, and again, seeking to encourage the Church of England to return to a robust biblical faith. Because all of the founders were Calvinists, and that's my team. So you know, they would argue not, and I get it. I compress for comic effect. But
I think there's a lot of truth in that. You mentioned your team in the Church of England, and rightly or wrongly, people often describe the Church of England as basically forming three different teams, camps, parties. Yep. There's the evangelicals, there's the liberals,
yeah,
and there's the kind of Anglo-Catholics,
yeah,
and you fit into one of those three.
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
And arguably the reason the Church of England works, if you're someone who thinks it does work,
yeah,
is because these three groups almost sort of hold each other in tension or hold them accountable.
Yeah.
But if I'm understanding you correctly, what you're saying was, well, actually, in your view, no, one of those teams was the kind of founders of the church,
well,
and you're trying to draw the other two camps back into what it originally was.
Yes, although it was originally a Roman church, and therefore the Anglo-Catholics would say, well, we were here first. And at which point you have to go, yep, okay. But actually, I would have much more in common with those guys because I think the way they express their faith is more formal than necessarily I think is required. But I'm much more comfortable, especially as you get older, with liturgy and with the rites, R-I-T-E, and the rituals, as it were, because you sort of understand the meaning of them. And you see, and I think one of the critiques, rightly, that they would have of evangelicalism is that it starts to get pretty naff and meaningless quite quickly once those ceremonies are removed. So we kind of want to remove the Pharisaical rituals. But actually, much as we say we don't like liturgy, we don't half use the same words all the time.
Yeah.
And our prayers don't half sound very similar.
And I guess the liturgies don't have to be Pharisaical, right?
Absolutely,
there
yeah.
Can be life, in
and that's your
well.
And that's your heart, you know. And yeah. So in a way, I have a lot of sympathy for the fact that these things do all coalesce. And actually, we can. And that one of the things I've really enjoyed about General Synod is the fact that I can stand there and say the Apostles' Creed, which is a very long and very specific thing to say, and believe that we all basically believe these things, and that's not bad. That's something. And that's a pretty good starting point.
Yes.
But then, of course, the you know, possibly literally, the devil is in the detail. And you know, and then we sort of start pulling in slightly different directions.
There was that brilliant moment, I think, in the Houses of Parliament where it might be an MP stood up and referred to General Synod, thinking it was a general, he or she was a general in the army.
Right.
Rather than General Synod being
wow.
the governing body of the Church of England, I believe
please,
is the appropriate
no.
term.
Oh my goodness.
So you're part of the governing body of the Church of England in that regard. If General Synods were to, I mean, to take the kind of the big example that a lot of people talk about at the moment, if the Church of England were to change its position on something like gay marriage, would that then be time for you to leave?
It is hard to know where the points are where you just think, you know what, I'm done here. And when I've spoken to people in other denominations, they do say, well, you know, the grass isn't as green on the other side of the fence as you might think it is, and they're all fighting other battles over other things. And undoubtedly, the position of my church within the town centre, it has big, wide open doors where people come in and we can preach the gospel to people. And that is not a position that, as an evangelical and an evangelistic evangelical, that one would be keen to throw away. But there does come a point where you just think, this isn't what the Bible teaches. And I think the Bible is clear on this. And I think there are some things over which we can disagree. And I have, for example, over what even constitutes a Christian. Is it somebody who is baptized or not, or infant baptized, or baptized as an adult, or whatever it is? And actually, you know, loads of my favorite authors hold different positions for me on that. But then there are other things which you think, I think the scripture is clear on this particular issue or that particular issue. And at that point, I don't think in conscience I can sit alongside that. And it's a very painful and frustrating thing, and everyone's lines are in slightly different places. And that's the beauty of the New Testament, particularly, is the honesty that we all have slightly different consciences that are from God, and that we don't need to throw people under the bus for having a different biting point for their conscience than we do. And we don't have to say, you ungodly people, for tolerating this great abomination. And there are others who you know, would express themselves very differently. It is a difficult process.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you do have to say, well, I can't go here. We're always inching towards these sorts of things. But at the moment, there is no official change to the canon law. And I don't think that if a change to the canon law were proposed now, that would pass all
right.
three houses of the General Synod. So in one sense, I guess I'll cross that bridge when I come to
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. So thinking about, you know, all we talked about in your life and your career and your faith, how would you describe your calling?
I think at the moment it's something that I'm really thinking about, in terms of, I spent the last 20 years writing quite a lot of sitcoms, and I think I've written or co-written about 150 half
wow.
hours for the BBC, for TV and radio, which
wow.
seems, that's not
pretty
a bad
decent.
Start.
We'll go
yeah.
with that.
Yeah, that's all right. I'm 43. Galton and Simpson are still some way off. They wrote more than that. But also, I do. So that is something that I do feel I like doing, and I like working in that way, and without sounding sanctimonious, in that kind of way that you get in Chariots of Fire. You know, when he says, you know, he's going to go off to become a missionary, but he wants to compete in the Olympics. And when she says, "Why do you want to do that?" he says, "Because God made me fast, and when I run, I feel God's pleasure." And yeah. I think I do feel that God has given me those gifts, which I do like to use in His. And I do think that is something I've been called to do. But the other thing is, I do enjoy, and I'm increasingly drawn towards encouraging Christians to have more confidence in their own Christian story, because I think culturally we are we're going to be severely tested in the coming years and decades. And actually, if we don't know who we are and where we've come from as a church, I think we're in danger, which is why I've been drawn towards writing about this. Next year we celebrate the murder of Thomas Becket. Odd thing to celebrate, I know, but yeah. But it is a momentous thing. As, again, for me as a sort of a Calvinist, I'm not really on the Becket team on one level, but it's a really interesting story, and I think in many ways he did the right thing, and I admire his stand on these things. And I wrote a show about Martin Luther and the 95 Theses called A Monk's Tale.
Which I saw at Edinburgh Fringe and I love.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. And the CD, the audio CD is available at amonkstale.net. There we go, got that in. But I think Christians need to know these stories. And I'm suddenly become much more interested in the story of William Tyndale, who I think does not get enough credit for his Bible translating work and giving us an English Bible and having to go on the run and ultimately paying with his life. And telling those stories to say, look, we may feel under attack. We may feel like the establishment is not interested in a biblical Christian faith, but we've been here before, and these are the guys that have and the guys and the girls that have got us through, and have shown how God blesses and honors those. And sometimes we die, and sometimes we survive. So I think I'm really drawn to doing more in that kind of space as well, and what that looks like in the future. I don't really know, but I'm quite excited about it.
Watch this space. James Carey, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure to talk.
Thank you for having me.
There you have it. That was my conversation with the sitcom writer James Carey. Covered a lot of ground there. I do hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did. We're bringing you a different Profile interview every single week here on the Profile podcast. If you search back through our archive, you'll find well over 100 different interviews that myself and other members of the team here at Premier have conducted. It's all made possible by Premier Christianity magazine. That's the magazine that I edit, and it sponsors this show. If you would like to have a look at what we're doing with the print magazine, you can request one free copy, your first copy of the magazine, completely free. There's no obligation to subscribe. We just want you to have a look and see if it's the sort of thing you might find interesting, relevant, and helpful to receive on a regular basis. But get that first copy completely free. Just go to our website, premierchristianity.com/freesample. Our May edition is out now. It features an interview with Christian Concerns' Andrea Williams. We're also looking at the topic of secularism. Is it on the rise in the UK? And if so, should Christians be worried? Trevin Wax has a fantastic culture column on authenticity. How should Christians understand that concept? And we've also interviewed the worship leader, Lou Fellingham. Get a free copy, premierchristianity.com. And one more thing before we go. If you did enjoy this episode of the Profile podcast, we would so appreciate it if you take a moment to give us a rating and a review wherever you got this. So go on, just takes a couple of clicks, couple of swipes. It would really help us out. It allows more people to discover this content. So if you are able to rate and review us, we would so appreciate it. Thanks for joining us on the Profile podcast. I have been Sam Hales in conversation with James Carey. We will see you next time.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have Leaf Filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A Leaf Filter Trusted Pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install Leaf Filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, Leaf Filter Trusted Pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.